Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news ad free. That's amazon.com/news ad free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Coming up on DTNS, Apple's opening up its doors again, but what will it mean for the remote workers? Google says Canada's Bill C-10 is worrisome for both creators and users, and the Supreme Court narrows the scope on the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act. This is the Daily Tech News for Thursday, May 3rd, 2021. From Studio Redwood, I'm Sarah Lane.
In lovely Cleveland, Ohio, I'm Rich Straffolino.
From Austin, Texas, I'm Justin Robert Young.
And I'm the show's producer, Roger Chang.
Before the show, we were talking about Justin's new bird, how birds' beaks get to the beautiful shape that they're in, and dogs, cats, and birds sometimes getting along, and sometimes not. You never know what you're going to get on Good Day Internet. If you want to be part of that wider conversation, do so by becoming a member at patreon.com/DTNS. Let's start with a few tech things you should know.
Twitter launched its subscription plan called Twitter Blue, which provides the ability to undo a just-sent tweet and access new themes and bookmarks, with additional features coming alongside the U.S. rollout. That's right, it's not available in the U.S. right now. It is available in Canada for $3.49 Canadian a month and Australia for $4.49 Australian, and will be released in the United States later this year.
Facebook CEO Mark Zuckerberg and WhatsApp head Will Cathcart confirmed in an interview with WABetaInfo.com that WhatsApp will support multiple devices, starting with an upcoming public beta, so users can access their accounts from up to four linked devices. New features include View Once, which will let users send content that disappears after it's been viewed, and Disappearing Mode, which will let users turn on disappearing messages across all chat threads.
Amazon's camera unit Ring announced in a blog post it will make requests from public safety agencies such as police and fire departments for users' video footage more transparent. Requests for material must now be posted publicly in Ring's Neighbors app. The request for assistance feature in the Neighbors app will roll out starting next week, requiring user approval for requests from verified agency profiles with request history logged online so users can see how their police force is using the posts.
The American Heart Association says that devices with Apple's MagSafe technology can cause interference when they're placed near cardiac devices such as pacemakers. The researchers from the AHA say that their findings highlight the importance of public awareness regarding an interaction between cardiac implantable electronic devices, or CIED, and a recently released model with magnetic charging capabilities.
And Google announced in an email to Play Store developers that later this year, it will cut off access to advertising IDs that track users who've opted out of receiving personalized ads. After a user opts out, developers will simply see a string of zeros in its place. Google has also updated its support page for advertising IDs with the announcement.
All right, Justin, sounds like everyone's going back to the office, or at least they are at one company.
Mm-hmm. Apple CEO Tim Cook sent out an email to employees asking them to partially return to their main campus starting on September. Tim Cook said most people will be expected to come in on Mondays, Tuesdays, and Thursdays at a minimum, with the option to work from home on Wednesdays and Fridays. Teams that need to work in person will return 4 to 5 days a week. Cook said employees can also work remotely for up to 2 weeks a year to be closer to family and loved ones, find a change of scenery, manage unexpected travel, or a different reason all your own, though managers need to approve these remote work requests.
Wow. So, okay. I think we were all wondering at what point do some of the companies who have been, I don't want to say they've been very lax about remote work, because what choice did really anybody have, you know, this time last year? But yeah, for the Googles and the Facebooks and the Twitters and the Apples, and these are, you know, large, not, I'm of course naming companies in Silicon Valley, but companies that made very public, hey, we're, you know, everyone's going to be remote, and maybe for the foreseeable future, when some of that was going to start to reverse course. And I think in Apple's case, it's interesting because just built that beautiful new campus. We've seen it in Apple's remote announcements of various products because they haven't been doing in-person events. But otherwise, yeah, I kind of wondered when was this going to start happening? And I guess the time is now.
I mean, I would say for people who work down there that you would want to go in now before the traffic gets bad. It's actually like a 20-minute drive from the East Bay or San Francisco down to that campus when it will almost certainly be the hour and a half that it normally is eventually. This is a lot of follow the leader, like you pointed out, Sarah. Everybody is going to eventually sort of cascade in these announcements. I wouldn't be shocked if they look a lot like what Apple said. But what I'm more interested in is how he mentioned the floating 2-week work from home totally idea, because what I had not considered is some of these companies taking the pattern interruption that COVID was and trying to be a little bit more progressive about overall work agreements. This is the same kind of way that a lot of tech companies started offering unlimited vacation, as opposed to what we had traditionally understood of you getting 2 weeks a year, 5 days a year, blah, 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 that you would save up over time. And then when you left, you'd either have to use them or you would get the commensurate pay for that amount of money. I think that this, to me, the floating 2 weeks work from home sounds a lot like that. And I'd be curious on whether or not eventually we get back to a 5 day a week work week with maybe a floating bank where you could always take Fridays off if that's what you wanted to do with it, or you could save it and say, well, I'm going to work half the year from somewhere else.
Yeah, it seems like this is like the opposite side of the coin of what Microsoft has kind of been hinting at, what they're going to be doing, at least in a lot of like their surveys about the future of hybrid work and stuff like that, where it's more of the, okay, you can kind of work from either. There are going to be some days you're going to be required to come in and actually be in the office. I also wonder if Apple's kind of, I don't know, it's not a unique position, but they're very much still a product company. Services certainly play a large part of it. But, you know, physically making products is still the bedrock of their business. And I do think that there is something that you can only do in an office to a certain degree. Obviously, they've been able to very successfully continue product development over the past 16 months. But I do wonder if that puts a little bit more of an emphasis in going back into the office. I mean, because all of these giant tech companies have extensive campuses and real estate holdings and stuff like that, that would incentivize them to theoretically use that. But we're not necessarily seeing a rush to it, not even a rush to it, but a call to it like Apple has just put out.
Yeah, I think it too, the mandatory, okay, let's all rethink how we do our days, you know, rethink childcare, rethink, you know, where you sit at your desk at home because you didn't have an office before. All of those things were done in a rushed way. And so I think this is, I mean, certainly Apple, but a lot of other companies will be watching closely, because Apple wouldn't do this unless the company was thinking to itself, okay, we've gotten through a certain period. We're doing okay, but this will make things that much better. And once this does go into effect in September, then there's going to be another period of time where it's like, okay, is it actually better? We thought it was going to be. Because when I look at this, I'm like, it's kind of a complicated week. It's like, what days am I working from home? What days am I going to the office? Sure, you get on a schedule and maybe that's great. Maybe the flexibility works, but it almost adds in, at least on paper, a layer of complexity that I'm just not sure anyone knows how that's going to play out just yet.
And also, can you imagine if Apple, Facebook, and Google all told everybody that they could work from home on Wednesday? It would totally eliminate traffic to the South Bay. It would be a marvel.
Yeah. Well, in a blog post, Google voiced some concerns about negative effects of Canada's Bill C-10 and the impact it may have on creators and also Canadian viewers of videos on YouTube. Bill C-10 would let the Canadian Radio, Television and Telecommunications Commission, or the CRTC, set discoverability requirements for Canadian creators so that a certain amount of Canadian content will appear in users' recommended videos. Google writes, quote, "If someone is searching for Canadian content, we will show them Canadian content. But if a student is researching American history or someone is looking for the best way to fix a flat tire, we want to make sure they have access to the most relevant content for their needs." Google argues that C10 won't let Canadians see video suggestions based on their personal preferences, but instead what the government decides is Canadian.
This is fascinating, and it's something that is not new to Canadian law in terms of mandating certain amounts of Canadian-made content, right, Roger?
This is correct. So the whole idea behind Bill C-10 is to update Canada's Broadcasting Act, which in its formulation was designed to promote Canadian content as part of the regulatory, the CRTC, which is like the FCC here in the U.S., to mandate certain percentage of Canadian content. For example, broadcast stations currently require at least 60% of the content per year is of Canadian origin, and 50% of programming from 6 p.m. to midnight must be Canadian origin. And so the idea is to broaden out that remit to cover online streaming platforms like YouTube, like Netflix, like your Hulus. And a lot of the pushback comes back because the opponents of the way the bill is currently written say that those rules were written when broadcast spectrum was scarce and not available to everyone. Not everyone could start up their own TV station. Not everyone could start up their own radio station. As opposed to YouTube, which is a platform anyone can start up a channel and they can do whatever kind of content they want. Really, I think the crux of the issue is that the way it is currently written is very broad and gives the CRTC a lot of leeway in deciding what rules apply, what rules don't apply. And so what the opponents are saying is that you just kind of have to take it on good faith that this government agency will do, quote unquote, the right thing when it comes to this content. And they're worried that if you do put in strict mandatory content rating or quotas, that could potentially, for example, if Netflix needs to have 30% of their content to be Canadian origin, are they going to expand the amount of Canadian production, or are they just going to shrink the library down so that they meet that weighted measure? And so there's a lot of vagaries and a lot of vagueness to it that they want to see a little more basically to have something a little more explicit and guarantees of protecting content creators in Canada so they're not necessarily seen as broadcasters and then subject to those same types of rules.
Yeah, I mean, I can absolutely understand why Google's like, well, this is totally going to screw up our algorithm. We're just trying to give the people what they want, not necessarily weight it to be Canadian versus the information from everywhere else. If that is something that YouTube is going to have to provide in Canada, what does it mean for other areas of the world? I see why both are arguing for what they want.
And where I think there's a lot of confusion on this is that initially there was in the bill an exemption for user-generated content, which was subsequently taken out. The line on this has always been, listen, this is really for impacting large platforms. But again, Roger, getting back to the vagueness of kind of how this will be implemented and getting into the fact that like just defining like what counts as a Canadian production has this very complicated, system. Your director, if you're a Canadian director, you get 2 points, screenwriter, 2 points. Like it gets very nitty gritty. And I wonder, even if you're a large YouTube creator, I wonder how they kind of quantify that in a way that can be enforced and useful to users.
And ultimately, I mean, a lot of the messaging on this has been kind of incredibly vague. For example, the Heritage Minister, Stephen, I'm going to mispronounce his name, Stephen Guilbeault, I hope I'm pronouncing it correctly, is basically said in an interview that it would not apply to individual content users unless they reach a certain threshold of subscribers, which can mean like, is it a million? Is it 500,000? Is it three? You know, again, there's a lot of vagueness to it. And a lot of people are like, well, you know, can you just make it a little more explicit? Can you say that, you know, content creators on YouTube or Twitch or TikTok aren't subjected to this? So if I make a super awesome TikTok video that goes viral and I get like 10 million subscribers, suddenly I'm not a broadcaster and subject to these rules.
All right. Well, Roger and Justin and Sarah, do you like finding free stuff online but don't want to sign up as part of a social network to do it? I know I do. Well, Nextdoor just launched a new feature called Free Finds that might be what you're looking for, sort of. It's a feed of local giveaways, and it's available to browse without signing up for a Nextdoor account. If you want to contact a seller about picking up said item, then you do need to go through with the account sign up. You can be able to verify your location. If your cell billing address is the same as your physical address, you can do it by text, and it's pretty instantaneous that way. Otherwise, you have to go through Nextdoor's mail-in system. Odds are your free thing will be gone at that point. Free and buy nothing groups are kind of all over Facebook and other social media groups, and Nextdoor has also seen its own finds marketplace listings up 80% since the start of 2020, with 25% of those listings free items. Kind of an interesting way, I think, to, you know, kind of grow their user base, kind of with this explosion of, we've seen it with Facebook Marketplace kind of increasingly popular, kind of leveraging this in the same way.
I guess the only reason I think this will work is for people who have heard enough terrible things about other Nextdoor users, and they say, I don't want to be part of that, you know, just a bunch of people tattling on each other, right? Oh, Nextdoor, it's for, you know, the neighborhood, you know, busybodies and nosy folks and people, not being very neighborly. I am part of my local Nextdoor community. I don't look at it every day, but I'm in there enough. I know in general what's going on. And free things or stuff for sale is a big part of that. And I guess if I was like, gosh, I hate Nextdoor. What a crappy place to to gossip about my neighbors. But I wish I could find some free dining chairs. This would at least give me an entry in. Otherwise, it kind of seems like something that Nextdoor already offers. It's pretty simplified.
I think the idea is that you have more people that are looking at it by making a free version of it. And everybody can complain about Nextdoor until there's a loud noise and you want to see whether or not somebody saw the Transformer explode. there is a reality there that I think this is huge. To be honest, this has been such a gigantic part of our existence, personally, moving, where we gave away a lot of stuff, and now we've kept our eye out on our own new neighborhood to find stuff to fill in the gaps of the new place, that I'm kind of surprised that we have not gotten a full-on dedicated social network to this, aside from the fact that nobody can monetize it, because the whole point of it is that you're giving things to each other peer-to-peer for free.
Yeah.
The one thing I'll say is this is like still walled gardens, but Nextdoor is just installing a really big window into one room. And I could see them doing the same thing with like events and that kind of stuff, which is a huge draw for Facebook. Same thing with Facebook Marketplace. I could see them being like, hey, you can view these community events that are happening going on. If you want to RSVP, you need to sign up and get you in. I could see that being an effective way for them to grow their user base.
Amazon.
Well, One second, Justin. Before you get to that, just want to remind folks, if you want us to talk about anything in particular, something that's come across your desk, you might let us know by submitting that story to our subreddit. Submit stories and vote on them at dailytechnewsshow.reddit.com.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites.
So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
My business used to be weighed down by the complexities of in-person payments. Then, Stripe Tap to Pay on iPhone came along and changed everything. With Stripe, I streamlined my payment process effortlessly. No more juggling different methods. Just a simple tap on my iPhone and transactions are complete. What's truly remarkable is how Stripe caters to all my customers' preferences. Whether they're using cards, Apple Pay, or other digital wallets, Stripe ensures a smooth checkout experience every time. Setting up Stripe was a breeze, taking just minutes to get up and running. From local markets to global retailers, Stripe helped me expand my reach and grow my business with ease. To learn how Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe can help grow your revenue and reach, visit stripe.com/tapiphone.
Amazon, like I was saying before I totally scrolled past the plug, it's adding a new feature for Halo, its fitness tracker, an app called Movement that measures how a person moves and areas of improvement and offers up curated exercises. Users will have to record themselves performing various exercises using the phone's camera. With that information, the Movement app will offer routines based on user-specific problem areas that will improve exercise, form, and mobility. There are a total of 35 possible corrective exercises, and the program was designed by physical therapist and author Dr. Kelly Starrett.
Of CrossFit fame,
This is a really interesting kind of direction for Amazon to take their, for their fitness wearable, kind of their fitness ambitions in general, because at least from, you know, the Apple perspective, what they're doing with Apple Watch is, or with Apple Fitness. Plus, right. That is very much kind of in the Peloton realm of, hey, you're going to have on your TV screen, there's going to be people in front of you that are doing this exact same thing that you're doing. You're part of this group that you're all doing this and it's all great. And you're getting positive feedback to keep going, keep exercising. And that kind of takes away from the weirdness that you're sitting in front of your Apple TV or your iPad in your living room and doing this by yourself. This is very much in the more personalized healthcare situation. We've seen that taking off a little bit more kind of in the medical field, it kind of looks personalized healthcare. And Amazon is banking on that. I wonder though if, hey, set up your phone and do these stretching exercises by yourself and we're going to tell you when you do them wrong. Certainly useful. I don't know if that's the feeling that people want when they do this. Now, I haven't used it, so I don't know. You know, maybe there is like a positive reinforcement dynamic that kind of mitigates this. That would be just like, that was just my first thought, like kind of looking at this.
Well, as far as I understand it, and I don't have a Halo fitness tracker, but Amazon is definitely going with the, we want to give you data and stats that make sense to you. You know, what's your body mass index? Well, what if we say it a different way so it makes more sense to you, whether your goals are weight loss or, you know, improved mobility or strength or, you know, your shoulders have better range of motion, all of that stuff. So when I think about this all the time because I do a lot of fitness wearing my Oculus Quest, you know, it's like VR working out. And a lot of the time I kind of look at my Fitbit, which is the fitness tracker that I use after I'm done with a workout. And I go like, okay, I burned, you know, 350 calories. That sounds pretty good. But I mean, what if I was squatting improperly the whole time and doing, you know, incremental damage to my back every time? Yeah. And there's a way to have known that ahead of time where I could make adjustments. I'm not saying that Amazon has cracked the code on this. I mean, it's obviously not the same thing as going to a physical therapist, but that kind of data, I think for a lot of people, especially people who are saying, well, I don't really feel good or something kind of hurts or I'm not seeing the results that I was expecting. Being able to adjust the way that you're trying to do something correctly can be really helpful.
Absolutely. And I think that this is a whole different version of kind of fitness. The idea there used to be this kiosk at the gym that I was at that would have you do what I presume to be similar ideas here. 10 squats, 10 jumping jacks, stuff like that. It would then map out kind of the joint positions and point out that, okay, you are leaning too much on this side, or you are doing things improperly. And so I presume that the next step there would, they would try to sell me some plan where I would go forward and correct these things. That's where I think you get the feedback. is you do the exercises, and then you get your diagnosis. You then get what is essentially, I don't want to say physical therapy, but some sort of set of exercises that would help to correct that. And then you do the 10 jumping jacks again, and you're like, oh, wow, look at this. Amazingly better form, even if it's incremental. So I think it's an interesting idea, and something that gets us a little bit more coherent in our quantifiable self-revolution, where we have nothing but information and not a whole lot else to show for it.
The U.S. Supreme Court has slashed the scope of the 1986 Computer Fraud and Abuse Act in a 6-3 decision handed down Thursday. This means federal prosecutors can no longer use this law to charge people who misused databases that they are otherwise entitled to access. Now, the central case involved Nathan Van Buren, a police officer in Georgia, who searched a license plate database for an acquaintance in exchange for cash, and whether he violated U.S. hacking laws by doing so. Van Buren was originally prosecuted on two counts. The first, which was thrown out, was for accepting money for accessing the database as a serving police officer. The second was for violating the CFAA, which was upheld until now. And the legal question wasn't whether or not he had broken the rules. He had broken the rules, but whether or not he had exceeded his authorized access by obtaining the data. Justice Amy Coney Barrett said in the majority ruling, quote, "The government's interpretation of the statute would attach criminal penalties to a breathtaking amount of commonplace computer activity. If the exceeds authorized access clause criminalizes every violation of a computer use policy, then millions of otherwise law-abiding citizens are criminals."
So this was something that civil libertarians had long contended was overreach by the government. It was additional prosecution and often possible jail time or fines on top of what would be other crimes, because you could put this on top of it, and then that would give more leeway to prosecutors to do all sorts of prosecutorial things. What's interesting here is the coalition. The 6-3 came from all the liberal justices and all three justices that were appointed by Donald Trump. The three came from the other side of the conservative side of the bench that had not recently been put on. But it does bear at least maybe some sign of optimism that a more coherent view of some of these older laws, specifically as it comes to computer issues, might be looked at with maybe a little younger eyes, maybe people that have set up their own email accounts.
Well, and the thing to keep in mind is also that accessing these databases that, you know, you're authorized to use for unintended or for unauthorized uses or, you know, whatever the particulars in this case may be, this may be against the terms of your employment. This may be against the terms of service of that workstation. So you could still lose your job. You could, you know, it's just that you cannot, at least under this ruling, be brought up under, you know, this sets the precedent. You can't be brought up under federal charges under the CFAA.
Right. You know,
exactly.
That's really what this is about, defining the scope of this law and therefore making it more potent and not something where, you know, in 1986, the concept of this many databases was something really not foreseen by the users of or the creators of the law. And obviously was kind of used to overstretch their bounds by the prosecutors who were using it.
All right. Well, hey, we got some cool space news, because NASA's new administrator, Bill Nelson, announced Thursday the agency will spend $1 billion to send two new robotic missions to Venus by decade's end. NASA's first visit to the planet since the early 90s. The Da Vinci Plus mission, that stands for Deep Atmosphere Venus Investigation of Noble Gases, Chemistry, and Imaging Plus, very catchy and obvious, will measure noble gases to sort out the planet's origins and sniff for sulfur and carbon near the surface for evidence of recent volcanic activity. Meanwhile, the Veritas mission, Venus Emissivity Radio Science, INSAR Topography and
Spectroscopy.
Press. Yes, we'll use synthetic aperture radar to look through Venus's clouds and recreate its topography, revealing whether volcanoes or variants of tectonic plates are active on its surface. Venus, a notoriously inhospitable planet for kind of exploration, so using some cool tech and going to be getting some more information on that kind of moody planet.
And also, when it comes to Venus versus drones, Venus has a winning record. So let's not get too excited about whether or not these are going to, like, just don't expect Mars level information and excitement from either of these drones. Venus is way better at playing defense against drones.
Yeah, but I think
of all that hot water, Justin. You gotta get there and figure it out.
Exactly.
It'd be great. Yeah. When I first saw the story, I was like, oh, that's cool. Have we done that before? Yeah. In the 1990s, in fact. It's been a while, though. So hopefully we'll learn a lot more about tectonic plates on that hot planet.
They don't last long, so it'll be a flash in the pan.
Yeah. Well, best of luck, robots. Rich, did we get an email today?
Yes, we did. Mayor Vina sent us an email and said, quick question about the Amazon Mesh Network. If you have multiple devices, do you have to opt out of all devices, or is it an account-wide opt-out? Love the show. Take care.
Oh, Mayor Vina, that's a good question. We were talking about this with Allison Sheridan the other day. It was funny because Allison was like, I don't even have this option when I look at my Amazon account. Hopefully she has it since then. I had the option to opt out. I actually did not opt out. I'm okay with the Sidewalk network at this point. But yes, good news, Maravina, it is attached to your account. So if you have multiple Amazon accounts that you're using for multiple devices, you would have to do it by account. But yeah. But no, it's a blanket opt out. So that's good news. Right. If you have questions or comments or anything that we talk about on the show, you can send all of those emails, and we hope you do early and often because we love your feedback. Feedback@dailytechnewsshow.com. Shout out to patrons at our master and grandmaster levels. Today, they include Norm Fizikas, Chris Allen, and Mark Gibson. I would also like to send an extra special thanks, a virtual cupcake, to John and Becky Johnston, who are some of our top lifetime supporters for DTNS. Thank you for all the years of support, John and Becky.
Yes, thank you, thank you, and thank you to Justin Robert Young for being on the show today. Justin, you're all over the cyberspace, only accessing lawful databases in authorized ways. Where can people find more of your great stuff if they're so inclined?
Politics.com or PX3 podcast, if that's a little easier to remember. We have a great interview with the brand new host of Cheddar's primetime political show, None of the Above, J.D. Durkin. A friend of the show joins us to talk about his new program and the latest on infrastructure.
Excellent. We are on this show Monday through Friday. In fact, we do it live at 4:30 p.m. Eastern, 2030 UTC. You can find out more at dailytechnewsshow.com/live. And guess what? We're back at it tomorrow. We'll have Annalee News on the show with Glenn Peralta doing some drawing.
This show is part of the Frog Pants Network.
Frog Pants Network.
Get more shows like this at frogpants.com.
Diamond Club hopes you have enjoyed this program.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.